Thanks, everybody, for coming. And it's not a miracle I'm here, but I'm sort of, put it this way, my positive karma in air travel is now at a deficit because I had so much of it yesterday. I mean, the fact that I'm here astounds me because of the, my flight was canceled and they routed me through Chicago and it worked. I mean, I got the only flight that actually got here from Chicago yesterday, as far as I know. So, and even more on the karma, they upgraded me. So don't travel with me anytime soon. It's not going to be much fun, I can tell you. All right, I'm going to whip through a bunch of slides, and I hope then get quickly to a conversation. I want to kind of lay the framework for what I think is going on and how it seemed to me to be developing, and then maybe throw a few ideas out there for folks. And then at the end, Alex and David will tell you either why I'm completely full of crap or maybe onto something or something in between. So let's go from there. So just some data points, which I'm going to come back to. I don't like this old media, new media stuff. It's we media sort of feels better to me as where we're heading. And that the baseline for it is ubiquitous networks. The conditions in which this will grow is ubiquitous networks, inexpensive tools that are getting more powerful all the time, and that means that anyone can publish, and that that has pretty big implications as we go out, and that it's about a read-write web, you know, the web that developed in the early to mid, well, the mid-90s till about 2000 was kind of read-only. You had to kind of know things with HTML and other technology in order to publish. Now you don't really need to know much of anything, and that that has meaning for all of us. Now, blogs are what we hear about, but it's much, much more than blogs. And anybody who wants this, the slides, I'll be happy to give it to you later. There's SMS and texting, which is bigger in other countries than here. I knew when the Pentagon started doing podcasts that it was over. Video is starting to get amazing.
Okay, it's October 6th, 2005. I'm Amanda Congdon, and this is Rocket Boom.
That's a show based in New York that a couple of people put together every day, and it's not a threat yet to the evening broadcast, but it's quite good and done by just a couple of folks in a small studio. Something else going on is that it's not just about the journalist or the audience, but the people and institutions journalists cover, the newsmakers, have a new world that's been thrust upon them too, and something new is being done to them, and they have new opportunities to do things. I'll talk a little bit about that, but that's a much bigger subject. The Daily Me already exists. We can aggregate a bunch of different things into what we want, but where we're heading is kind of a daily we, and that is much more intriguing to me. It's the thing that I'm going to spend a lot of my time on as we go out. A little history on how I figured, at least how I decided this was happening. I've been teaching every fall in Hong Kong for a month or so at the University of Hong Kong, and these are events that go on that... this is not this slide, but I started putting together reports from the U.S. when I was out there and figuring I was getting better news accounts than I was getting from the U.S. And the September 11th was a turning point for a lot of things. This was how we all saw it at first. The TV was covering it, and it went on to web pages pretty quickly. But something else was going on, and I want to talk a little bit about that. I was in South Africa at the time doing workshops for African journalists on how to use the internet, and on the way to Zambia and with a small group. And it was hard to get American or English language things except on the web. And one of the things that I noticed in my email the next day was on a mailing list that a man named Dave Farber runs. He's a technology guy from Pennsylvania. He had a link. What he does every day is people send him things that they think might be interesting. He then, in turn, picks the ones that are, in his opinion, interesting and sends them out to his audience, which is now 50 or 60,000 people. One of the things that day was a satellite image of Lower Manhattan that was very striking, not something I'd seen elsewhere, and I had seen it via this mailing list, and I remember thinking that's really different. The bloggers were going crazy, of course, at the same time, and I remember one blog in particular. A guy in Brooklyn wrote, "Now I know what a burning city smells like." And I remember reading that and thinking, we used to say journalists wrote the first draft of history, but I think this guy was doing the first draft of history at some level. And I wasn't sure where that would go, but it was an important moment for me. At the same time, a guy in California named Tamim Ansari was sending an email to a few of his friends, this passionate email saying, I know he's from Afghanistan. He said, "I know you're going to bomb my country and invade, but before you do, here are a few things you should know." That mail went from those few friends to a few of their friends and then spread out like a phone tree, traditional phone tree. And at the end of it, he was on the web quickly on Salon, and then by the following week, he'd been on national television in the U.S., a source who kind of created himself from out at the edge of the network, and it had come through the middle and then back out again. Fast forward to another important moment in the We Media phenomenon. Trent Lott, then the leader of the Republicans in the U.S. Senate, at a birthday party for Strom Thurmond, waxes nostalgic for segregation, effectively. A kind of outrageous statement. The major media didn't exactly pick up on the story in a big way. They did. There were a couple of mentions, but it was kind of there and then gone. Something else happened in this kind of bubbling up thing, part of which is important to remember came from some Democratic operatives with email. In fact, the Shorenstein Center did a terrific study of this, which I recommend people look at. But the bloggers played a particularly important role in this thing that happened over the course of a few days. Bloggers on the left, first of all, said, "This is outrageous." And then a couple on the right said, "You know, they're right. That is outrageous. And he doesn't speak for me either." And after a few more days, the big media picked up the story again. And it wasn't that the bloggers brought down Strom Thurmond, but that there was a symbiosis, a process in which media of all types were interacting with each other. And again, it was something quite important in the way things were changing. A couple of months later, the space shuttle breaks up, entering the atmosphere. And again, there was an image from a satellite spotted by a blogger, and I circled the area in red there. That's the debris field coming back through the atmosphere. Another image of resonance and power that I hadn't seen elsewhere, and that was, is it journalism? I'm not sure. The same day, something much more important in the context that we're talking about. A former engineer from NASA, the space agency, on a mailing list where space buffs hang out, put up a note saying, "Now something hit the left wing as the thing was taking off. Maybe that was what it was." And indeed it was. It was the cause. And it was a data point, and an important one, by someone who had reason to know something, someone who knew more than the journalists, certainly, who were covering it at that moment. All of these things were data for me, just thinking, well, something's going on. That journalism, I believe, really is changing from the lecture mode, kind of like what I'm doing now, into something much closer to a conversation or seminar or something different. but much more of something we all do, and that the story or the broadcast is not the end, but something in the middle, and that if we take advantage of that, we can do better work. The first rule of conversation, of course, something journalists have not tended to do very well, that's listen. We listen to our sources pretty well. We don't listen to everyone else. I can give a million examples. And the reason I learned to listen was that I went to Silicon Valley to write about technology. And I learned quickly that my readers knew lots more than I did. And of course, even in 1994, they all had email and were not shy about telling me how much more they knew than I did. After being daunted by that initially, I thought, wow, this is great. These folks know all this stuff and I don't, and they're helping me be better at what I do. That was a great moment for me to wake up to that fact. I think this is true for all journalists, whatever they write about or cover, that collectively, by definition, the readers, the audience knows more, and that that's a tremendous opportunity and not something to worry about. And so I think it's also true parenthetically too, for all organizations, that people outside inevitably know more than the people inside. For the newsmakers, again, there's something new going on, something being done to them, and something they can do for themselves. And it all comes down to the sort of basic unit of the web in this new world, and that's the hyperlink. It's an outward-looking thing. And it basically it says, go there for more. And go there for more nuance, for more depth, more whatever. Part of that means that fact-checking becomes a more global exercise. When we post something, when we write something, people out there are checking. And they will come down on us hard if they think we're wrong. And of course, the most famous example for journalists was CBS News and the infamous 60 Minutes 2 report, where they did not do sufficient due diligence on the memoranda that they cited as evidence. The bloggers, I put up this for two reasons. One is that was the first posting I was able to find about the memos after the broadcast that started the firestorm. But the reason I put it up for another reason is that there's a flat statement in that headline, which is no more supportable at that point than was the report that CBS had done, which is to say, he said, this is forged. He didn't know. But CBS didn't know that they weren't forged. And in the end, it was the duty, I think, of the journalist to have done the due diligence that CBS did not do. I don't let the blogger off the hook. However, we should not be letting people off the hook. CBS did back down finally, which was after a bunch of stonewalling, which I think was to their discredit. By the way, there was a CBS executive, former executive, who was interviewed and talked about the bloggers as those people in pajamas. And those folks became known in the outside world as the Pajama Hadeen after that. Something else going on here is that, of course, companies are in a position where people tell each other about things, whether companies want them to know or not. There are a million stories here, but this is a case of how to fix something that the company that makes TiVo probably won't tell you how to do. And people inform each other about what's going on in other ways. People on the ground in Iraq are talking about things that they may not find in the major media. Some lessons here, it's getting harder to keep secrets. And digital technology does that. The way the word of SARS came out in Guangdong province in China was not because journalists covered it, but because people were sending text messages to each other. And eventually it got into the press. Another thing that's going on,
you can't take this medicine together. your use of this medicine has expired.
That's taken in Ken Sakamura's ubiquitous computing lab in Tokyo. He's putting RFID little radio tags into everyday objects and then connecting them to databases where you learn more about the object. And the idea is that not only can every person tell a story in this new world, but every object may start telling stories too. I'm not sure what the journalism implication of that is, but an interesting case study at Microsoft Research, Mark Smith did an experiment like this with barcodes that are on products, and he went to the supermarket with a handheld where he scanned the barcode, went to the barcode database to find out it was a box of cereal, and then goes to the Google rankings. The first Google result of that cereal was it had been recalled from the market, taken off the market. Turned out the reason it was taken off was that there was an ingredient in the cereal, but not in the list of ingredients, that was potentially deadly for some people. That, as Mark said, if every object can tell a story, and the story is, if you eat me, I will kill you, that's kind of one you want to hear ahead of time. So the newsmakers are starting to talk. They're starting to do other things, too. After 9/11, the Post did one of its endless series about what people in government were thinking, and as soon as it was up, Pentagon posted the entire transcript of Rumsfeld's interview with the reporters. Turns out they do this with every major interview. And my own opinion of this is it's a good thing. This is good for everybody. It's more depth, more nuance. We can learn things. It also means we have to be quoting people in context. As someone who's been quoted out of context, I think that would be a good thing. I could spend the rest of the day on this particular slide. We have got to find ways to raise the level of trust in these things and to sort out the lies from the truth and to make sure that truth catches up to things that are not true. In this new world, we, again, need to ask people outside for help. NASA asked for photographs after the space shuttle crashed. They asked people if they had any kind of picture of anything in the air, on the ground, send it in. They wanted to help get the pictures to help figure out what had happened. And 3,000 or 4,000 people did. News organizations are starting to do this now. It wasn't common then. The BBC, I think, was the first to do it in an organized way. They asked for some photos before the Iraq War started. And they got this enormous outpouring and ended up with an essay of real power. But I have to point out that people will do it whether we ask them or not in big media. This is the building next to the Australian Embassy in Jakarta right after the bombing a couple of years ago. And this was on a photo-sharing website before the media, major media, had gotten to the scene, much less gotten it onto their own publications or broadcasts. This is the now canonical image of the London bombings last July. A guy in the underground with a mobile phone camera takes this picture, and it was around the world within a day. Was he a journalist? Well, at that moment, I think he was. He may never be again, and certainly hadn't been before that. But at that moment, he had become one. This is I won't show it, but this is one of the tourist videos of the tsunami crashing ashore in Southeast Asia. It's important to remember, though, this is not all new. That people, passers-by or bystanders, have done something like citizen journalism for a long, long time. And the most famous, probably, of the last century was the Zapruder film of the Kennedy assassination. What's different now, and the important difference, is that pretty much in the future, pretty much most people are going to be carrying around digital cameras and video cameras, and that those cameras will be linked to networks So the ability to capture what you're seeing and then instantly get it out there. That's what's new, that this is going to be almost ubiquitous. There was one man in Dallas with a movie camera. Now there are thousands. Some more tools. I'm fond of this one. It's the satellite uplink in a suitcase. I think everyone needs this. And it's more than baby movies. Do you remember the MoveOn, did the Bush in 30 Seconds series?
If elected, I'll lie about weapons of mass destruction as a pretext to invade another country.
I'll call myself an environmentalist and gut clean air standards.
Our allies will go from respecting us to hating us. And I don't care. I'll leave no child behind. Unless they can't afford it.
I promise to keep you in a state of fear and anxiety so you never question what we're doing.
And if you do, we'll call you unpatriotic.
So they asked people with like low-end video equipment and computers no more powerful than this to create commercials, and people did. Some of them were really quite good. That was one of the finalists. The point of that is that, again, the tools are now so inexpensive and so powerful that lots of people can do this. I don't claim it's simple to do that, but a generation of people is coming along that is more fluent with video than perhaps I am with text. And for them, it'll be trivial. So where are we going? There's some things coming along that I like to, and that are already here. The idea of a self-assembling newsroom, I'm fond of this one. People who don't know each other created a site where they captured everything they could find going on about Iraq, and now they do politics. Our own Rebecca McKinnon here and Ethan Zuckerman are doing the wonderful Global Voices online, an aggregation network, and really inspiring people around the world to participate. This is one of the very important experiments, Wikipedia, where, in fact, the Globe had a front page piece on it today. Flawed in many ways, but also one of the important experiments in the whole world where anyone can work on this. There's a notion of mashups where you take data from that website and put it together with data or a service from that website using little hooks that programmers know how to put things together with. This is called ChicagoCrime.org, and it's done by a guy who now works for the Washington Post, so give them credit for knowing who to hire. He took Google Maps, Chicago database of crime data, and put it together. And you can go in at many levels here. Journalists should be doing this routinely at big organizations with varying kinds of data and giving people a way to annotate their own. I have lots of ideas on what they should be doing. Mashups, though, are mixing media in many ways, and again, there's this generation that's very fluent with video that is doing things like this. This is political commentary of high order, if I can get it to play.
There's only you in my life, the only thing that's bright.
My first name, your every breath that I take, your reverence for me.
That's commentary of tomorrow. we can get at the copyright question later. New models, business models. Well, Oh My News has a nation of freelancers. They're the other very important experiment, I think, in the world today. And they've convinced more than 40,000 people in Korea to be part of this. It's extraordinary. And Gadget and Gizmodo and other gadget sites, the business model for this is, of course, he sold the company to AOL for 15 million minimum is what I get, what I heard, and maybe 25. Not a bad business. Newspapers are starting to respond, and TV and radio. The News and Record in Greensboro, North Carolina, has decided it needs to be a town square for its community. And I'm watching this with huge interest because I think they may set a path for the rest of the newspaper industry. They're doing blogs, and they're quite good. It's a wonderful thing they're trying. And other media are starting to get hyper-local. This is in Bakersfield, California. They've picked out a quadrant of the city and done a website just for that and asked people to help out who are living in the area. It's profitable. But if they don't, others will. I, Brattleboro in Vermont, is one of the best of the news sites, at least from what I can see. And I'm trying to watch them all. But the thing we have to remember is that the journalistic threat to established media, I think, is not the interesting question. It's really not the real threat. It's the threat is this: the world's largest classified advertising operation. It's called eBay. They call it an auction site, but it's classified ads. Craigslist, classified ads. Eating at the margins, not the margins, taking away the business that makes newspapers run at any rate. Certainly, this is mostly true for newspapers, but it's becoming something more broad in the media. And it's important because the folks who are going after this are the folks who don't. It's the money that they're chasing in some level. They're doing better classifieds than the newspapers can. But these are companies that are well-funded, they're nimble, they're hungry for what they do. And the important thing is that doing journalism for Craigslist and for eBay, doing journalism would be a ridiculous distraction from the business that they're in. That's not true of journalism organizations. And I don't know how to fix that. I'm not nearly smart enough to tell you how to fix that broken business model for the news industry. I think going very, very local will help. We need to make sense of all this stuff coming at us, or flying by us anyway. Things that are various kinds of sites like these that are starting to organize it. This is one of the more recent ones called Dig that has a voting model that I'm intrigued by. Things I assume to be the case for the future is that this will all get faster, cheaper, and more powerful. That seems to be something we can count on. We need better conversation tools, ways of understanding reputation, and gauging what's good, what's not good, what's reliable, what's trustworthy. We need better tools for doing all of this, whether it's as an audience or as a contributor. It's pretty good, but it's not good enough. And data that about metadata is data about data. We need much more of it so we can track conversations and issues better. Something that I'll talk about more in upcoming talks this spring. I really believe that the more engaged one becomes with the news, with current events, the more likely it is one will become more active in a citizenship kind of way. It's a theory, anyway. And I think the media can help and should help. This is a site at the BBC called Action Network, where they're putting up tools so that people can create campaigns for change, or maybe for more of the same if they want to campaign for that. And the idea is they put up the tools, they help people find each other in their local areas, and then they watch people do the campaigns, and then they'll cover what people do. Not that they're telling them what to be doing, but they want to know what people care about and to help them do it and then cover it. It's an experiment that has not done that well yet, partly because there's no one at BBC who, no program really owns this. It's kind of free-floating and no one, it needs owners. But what I love about it is that they're doing, I think, a thing that journalists should be thinking about doing, which is helping people be more active as citizens. And that can only be good for us in every way. One of the first things that people did when they put this site up, which I thought was kind of proof of concept, was there was a campaign to take away public funding from the BBC. And they watched that and said, wow, I guess it works. Of course, they didn't lose their funding. My one political part of this, and that is a reminder that this is a read and write medium, but that Hollywood and increasingly I'm starting to think the book publishers and pretty soon everyone who does what we call content will have joined the idea that but Hollywood's leading the charge, and this is how they see the internet. You know, they have the button for volume and channel. They've added a button for interactivity that's called buy stuff. That's not my idea of interactivity, and it shouldn't be yours. We need to talk with each other. This is conversation. It's not just a marketplace. And the reason we should worry is that this could damage innovation, and it could damage where we're going. There are many things to worry about, but this is one of the ones. My shameless self-promotion slide for my book, which I will point out, is available for download for no charge if you go to the web. And it was published under a Creative Commons license, which instead of all rights reserved means some rights reserved. And in this case, the rights we reserved were that if you download it and give it away, that's fine, but just don't sell it. The principle is that if anyone's going to make money, we'd kind of prefer it was us. And that's how you reach me. And that's the talk part. And now for the listen part, I'm going to bring up David and Alex.